From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Chinese buyers eyeing FCA.
Chrysler is disappearing right before our eyes.
The shady poll that puts Kid Rock ahead of Senator Debbie Stabenow. Dig just a little deeper into who did that poll.
I couldn't find out a single real person who was in charge of this organization. There were a lot of fake people who were claiming fake names.
A young farmer's life in Michigan.
I think that it is a great time to go into agriculture right now. Whether it's raising livestock or vegetable production.
The Incubator Kitchen in Grand Rapids, making dreams come true.
We're actually not only producing startup food businesses, but we're working on producing young chefs as well.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Change is in the wind at FCA headquarters in Auburn Hills. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Daniel, earlier this week, Great Wall Motors of China said, hey, we're interested in buying Fiat Chrysler. What's going on here and how is this feeler received by FCA?
Well, I think they're going to listen to anything, frankly, at this stage of the game. I think the Chinese are most interested in Jeep and the Jeep brand, and who wouldn't be? I mean, of all the brands that FCA has worldwide, the most valuable brand with brand power and also volume and profitability is Jeep. And the Chinese have shown an interest in trying to buy their way into the established global auto industry. They're not in a position like, say, the Japanese, who can leverage a Toyota brand made in Japan or a Honda brand made in Japan and export it. Exporting a Chinese brand to the United States or to Western Europe is potentially very fraught because it doesn't have the kind of brand credibility that, say, Toyota and Honda do in Japan. So they're looking for ways to buy it and buy credibility. We've seen Geely, a Chinese manufacturer, buy Volvo from Ford in 2010, and that has turned out to be a very good deal for Volvo. For its volume, for its profitability, for its product development. They've clearly relied on Western auto people, including Swedish CEOs and Swedish executives, to run the show for the Chinese owners. So I think that's one model I think that people are looking at. But I also think that FCA on CEO Sergio Marchionne is looking at other ways to unlock value.
Because your headline in your column, FCA's on sales block again, fifth time a charm, ? That leads one to think that, you know, when you think of the merry-go-round of owners that Chrysler employees have gone through in Auburn Hills.
You've never seen anything like it. In the last 20 years, it's changed hands, what, three times? And it's come close, or at least it's been rumored, a fourth time with General Motors, first General Motors, and then Volkswagen, as Sergio Marchionne tried to cut a deal with each of those companies, and neither one of them were interested. And now we've got a fifth time where the Chinese are certainly looking at it. And I think Marchionne himself is looking at ways to extract value and potentially extricate the Agnelli family, which has been in the auto business for about 120 years, from the volume car business. I mean, if they had their way, they would probably still control Ferrari, maybe Maserati, the high-end Italian brands, maybe Alfa Romeo. But beyond that, I think they'd be happy just to see Fiat go away from their portfolio, as well as the Jeep brands, Jeep, Chrysler, Dodge, Ram.
Beloved here in America. Well, you call this a perennial Chrysler problem. Break this down for us, comparing FCA's position with GM and Ford. Why is FCA not in a position to play at their level in Auto 2.0? And by the way, what is Auto 2.0?
Auto 2.0 really is it's something that's been, it's a moniker that's being pushed by Wall Street. And I actually think it's pretty accurate and apt for this. Think of Auto 1.0 from Henry Ford and the creation of the moving assembly line right around the beginning of World War I to today, or a couple of years ago, basically, coming through the bailouts. The bailouts were a restructuring and a recapitalization of the traditional auto business that made cars and trucks, that employed people on the factory floor and in engineering and other things like that. 2.0 is what we also think of as mobility, electrification, and autonomy, self-driving cars. It's a whole nother phase of development in transportation that uses a lot of really advanced technology to deliver people and goods between points and other points.
And FCA, you say, is not in a position to play at GM and Ford's level in this world?
Right. And the answer to your question is, what are the perennial problems? One of the perennial problems that led initially to Chrysler agreeing to the stupidly named merger of equals with Daimler-Benz in 1997 was that they didn't have scale. They didn't have enough geographic scale, and so they were very tightly concentrated in North America. They really were nowhere in Europe. They had very little going on in Asia. They needed scale. You need scale to get economies in manufacturing and engineering, but now you need it in terms of technological development. And they don't really have that. And you've seen they've kind of been on the sidelines. They've done some interesting things. They've got a contract with Google to produce Pacifica minivans for their autonomous driving program. They just recently cut a deal with BMW and Intel to develop an autonomous driving system. But they clearly have telegraphed that they are not in the business of developing their own systems. General Motors and Ford and Toyota and Volkswagen, kind of the big four or five, Renault, Nissan, they're going and doing their own thing, working with partners where they think it's necessary, acquiring high-tech shops and startups where they think it will help them in developing their own systems. But they clearly have got the scale and the intent to try and do as much of this on their own as they can. And I think what Marchionne is saying is he's finally recognizing publicly that this is for real and they've got to figure out a way to get into it, but ultimately they can't do it all on their own. So what Chrysler's perennial problem is a lack of scale and arguably maybe not the right brands. I mean, what's also interesting here is Chrysler is disappearing right before our eyes. Essentially, Chrysler is two vehicles. It's the Pacifica minivan, which is considered one of the best minivans in the business, to the extent minivans are popular with buyers, and the Chrysler 300 sedan. They've eliminated the 200. What else is there? It is disappearing. It's getting close to 1% of the U.S. market, which is nothing. Same thing with Dodge. They've cut out some of their car product. So where they really are putting a lot of their eggs, so to speak, is in Jeep and Ram pickups. And those are the two brands that are generating almost all of the profitability for the company.
And they're the ones that could be spun off. Is that
and that gets to the next question, if I may. And that is, people talk about excising Jeep. Well, if you excise Jeep from the group and leave behind Ram, Dodge, and Chrysler, what buyer is going to go buy that company or be interested in partnering with that company, let alone buying it, if the most valuable asset globally with the most valuable global brand is owned by somebody else? So I think one of the things that we understand that Chrysler or FCA executives are looking at is possibly spinning off Maserati and Alfa Romeo, either in a partnership or actually spinning them off in toto to someone else, and then maintaining the remaining North America brands and either A, trying to operate them, or B, probably package them up for a sale that ultimately would get the Agnelli clan to exit the volume car business.
And as you say in your column today, choosing to do nothing is not an option.
That's exactly right.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Take one 385-pound piano, strap it on a great big tricycle, add a piano player, and then hit the road from Flint to Mackinac. Do all of that, and you have a memorable fundraiser sprint for Flint for a very great cause. Mark Braun is the pianist, better known as Mr. B. So glad to have you here, Mark.
Hey, I'm real happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you're going to bike, swim,
yes,
and play,
yes,
your way from Flint all the way to Mackinac Island.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Towing
the piano. Take 52 riders. Each rider is paying us a substantial sum to be part of an overall fundraising effort. So they'll ride in pairs on the back of the piano bike. It takes three people to propel it at one time. Once we get there, we're going to put it on a 51-foot barge, and nine of us will take turns three at a time by tying it to our feet and swimming it 5 miles across open water to Mackinac Island.
Now, you are a fit-looking guy. Is this something
saying so. I'm trying.
I think so.
Yeah,
I can tell you've got some guns here. So you're going to be able to do the swimming?
Oh, yeah. Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, but I'm the least talented swimmer of all. We have one guy that holds 19 world records. We have two women that hold multiple world records and were All-American swimmers in college. We have one other swimmer who is top five for all freestyle disciplines.
So So you've got some swimming power.
We have some
well.
Great swimmers.
So you and the gang, people who have donated because you're doing all of this for Youth Quest in Flint, right?
That's
to
right.
benefit them.
That's right.
This idea is ultimately to deliver you up to Mackinac because you're going to be playing the piano up in Mackinac over the Labor Day weekend.
Right, right. I'm a featured performer at the Labor Day Jazz Festival at the Grand Hotel. So it's ride, swim, play, give. The last fourth component, Sprint for Flint, being the most important. It's all a fundraiser. And Youth Quest is 2,000 kids a day all year long. They get a meal every day up in Flint. They get access to tutoring, multiple clubs and activities available to them. And they're our sole beneficiary.
That's great. Can you play the piano as it's being biked along?
No.
That's a little much.
I can do it in parade routes. You know, if we're in a city and we're going 2 miles an hour you can do that. But otherwise, no, this is a sprint. This is going to be hard. This piano, the bike weighs 620 pounds.
Oh, boy.
So to ride it from Flint to Mackinac within 24 hours, we'll be on the move. You know, it's a real concerted athletic effort.
I should have checked on MapQuest. How many miles is that?
It's 240 miles the route we're taking.
And you plan to do it in how much time?
24 hours. Maybe a bit longer. You know, we'll see how it really works out. The initial goal is 24 hours. I think our most current schedule allows just a little bit longer than that if we can keep to schedule.
I will venture to say there are going to be some pretty numb butts.
I think so.
Have you been training?
Oh, ferociously for a year and a half. Yeah, ferociously.
This is great. And I know that you are going to head off tomorrow at 9:30 with a kickoff ceremony. Actually, the kickoff ceremony Friday, 8:30 at Brush Park in downtown Flint. What's
That's
happening
right.
tomorrow at 8:30?
Well, a bunch of kids from Youth Quest and whole city of Flint is invited. So we expect, you know, many dozens of people on their bicycles to accompany us out of Flint. We're going to play a concert with my trio in the park before we go. And then the three musicians will be the first riders and the first leg of the ride. So pairs ride on the back in 10-mile increments. So they'll ride the first 10 miles. But we expect to arrive in Mackinac City, you know, around noon, probably maybe a little later on Saturday morning. We'll see.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. B, Mark Braun, pianist best known all over the state of Michigan and then some for his piano skills and now his bicycling, swimming, and fundraising skills.
It's a jamboree on the move.
Still to come, how is the newest generation of Michigan farmers approaching their ancient mission of agriculture? We'll hear from the owner of Presque Isle Farm. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The University of Michigan is marking its 200th birthday this weekend, shining a spotlight on August 26, 1817. But some sharp-eyed folks might ask, hey, wasn't there a U of M seal that read 1837, backed up by the fact the university held its centennial in 1937 and not 1917? All right, well, here to help sort out the facts behind the true birth of the University of Michigan is Jim Tobin. These days, he's a journalism professor at Miami of Ohio, but he did his PhD in history at U of M, and he was a reporter for the Detroit News. Welcome.
Thanks, Cindy. Good to be here.
Tell us what happened on August 26th in 1817.
This was the day when Governor Lewis Cass, governor of the Michigan Territory, and the so-called judges of the territory, who were really the legislators appointed by the federal government, decided that there would be an educational system headed by something called the University of Michigania. This is before statehood, 20 years before there was a state of Michigan. This would set up education in the territory. And so what they established was a corporate entity that had that name. There was no actual school yet. That took a little longer. That's what got started on this date in 1817.
What was around for education prior to this?
Oh, I think just tutors, a few common schools, church schools.
Right.
This was when Detroit was not a big city, of course. Not a tiny little town either, but a kind of mercantile center on the Great Lakes.
So it sounds like it was an effort to say, let's get some public education into the Michigan Territory.
Right. Let's get a system of education going. We're starting to get bigger. We have children who need education. Let's get it started.
So when did there become an actual campus and where was it located?
There was ever only in Detroit a single building on Bates Street near Cadillac Square. And that building was constructed or purchased, I'm not sure which, the following year, and classes began under a single teacher named Dickey, last name Dickey, and that was in 1818. And it was not anything like the university that we know today. It was a kind of academy to prepare students to go on to college or university elsewhere.
Almost what we might call today a high school prep.
A high school prep, yeah, exactly.
High school. So the land that this school, the University of Michigania, was to be on originally dated back to something called the Treaty of Fort Meigs with some Native American tribes?
Yes and no. The tribes gave, by that treaty, land that they held to the Michigan Territory. The territorial governors then sold land to create money for this educational system. Some of that money was used then to purchase this plot of land on Bates Street in Detroit.
So it put money in the piggy bank.
That's right.
In a sense.
They didn't use all of it for that purpose. They kept some of those monies, but that's where the original monies came from.
So 1817, this incorporation is the University of Michigania. By the next year, there is a building in Detroit. How did it wind up in Ann Arbor, and what's the significance of 1837?
This is a complicated story, but the little academy in Detroit kind of struggled for years. There wasn't much money to get things going, and there wasn't a whole lot of public support, and there weren't even very many students. So sort of the original plan broke down. It was reconstituted in the early 1820s, and then that kind of petered out. And so finally, there really wasn't anything at all. And then the move toward statehood came in the 1830s. The constitution of the new state was approved in 1835, and then after the so-called Toledo War, this boundary dispute with Ohio, the state actually joined the Union in 1837. And that was the year when the new constitution was approved and finalized, that a new University of Michigan was established. And it was to be established in Ann Arbor. The old 1817 Detroit facility was no more. And so the whole thing got restarted in Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor bid against other cities in the new state to be the headquarters of the university, and Ann Arbor won, partly because a group of landholders in Ann Arbor said, we'll give you that 40 acres that became the Diag. That looked like a good deal to the new legislature, so they said, okay, Ann Arbor, you can have it.
And there they got it.
And that's what happened. And so that's the reconstitution of the university in Ann Arbor. There's a board of regents elected. They choose the site for the campus. Mm-hmm. But it really isn't then until 1841, because of a financial crisis, that classes start to be taught. Buildings are put up, and the first classes are begun.
And so at that point is when the name morphed into the University of Michigan, because we had a state of Michigan.
Right. It was known as the University of Michigan from that point forward.
It sounds like, as you think about the bicentennial, I guess what we're focusing on is the public corporation that was always there.
That's exactly right. People don't really appreciate that it's that legal corporate public entity called the University of Michigan that was founded in 1817. That is the continuous entity that has been around for 200 years now.
Well, then we can say happy bicentennial to the University of Michigan.
Yes, indeed.
Jim Tobin, journalism professor at Miami of Ohio and regular contributor to Michigan Today. Always great to talk history with you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
What's the next generation of farmers doing to keep Michigan agriculture strong? According to the state's numbers, the food and agriculture industry brings in more than $101 billion to the state's economy every year. All week long, we're talking with young farmers who make up the future of this important and diverse industry. Molly and Dion Stepanski own Presque Isle Farm. It's a small centennial certified organic farm in northern Michigan. Presque Isle Farm's slogan is short and right to the point, eat your veggies. Molly and Dion, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How would you describe your farm for us? I'm wondering just how big and how much of your land is in production, Dion.
Right now, we're just growing on about 2 acres, so it's fairly small. We have 3 hoop houses in production as well that are 30 by 96 feet, so roughly close to 9,000 square feet of protected growing culture. The farm is on a 40-acre plot, and we have about 25 acres across the street from us of tillable land that we have access to as well. We're choosing not to use that right now. Our approach and our model is really to grow intensively on a small scale, producing a few small crops to funnel into the local community and stay local and not get too large, not branch out to too big of a wholesale market. We currently are... Our big push is a lettuce mix that we produce. That's kind of our main staple. And then we're also producing other greens like spinach and kale and some chard and some other baby greens. And then we produce tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers in the summer.
And Molly, who are your customers? Who buys your crops?
Well, sort of from the get-go, Cynthia, we realized that we needed more than just one market or a couple markets here and there. And so we are working with restaurants close by and a little bit further away on Mackinac Island. We're working with grocery and retailers in the Alpena area and down in Tawas City. Part of the way that we got our funding for Hoop Houses was through a spectacular grant through Hoop Houses for Health. And so we're able to work with a couple of local schools to get them free produce, which in turn pays for our Hoop Houses. And then we're in the Alpena Farmers Market. And then this year we've also started with the Rogers City Farmers Market as well.
Now, has this farm been in the family, Dion?
It's been in the family since mid-1800s, essentially, in through the Homestead Act. My great-great-great, I'm not even sure how many great,
way back great.
Grandparents, they basically set up a homestead there. It was passed down through the family for a few generations and then ended up in my great-grandfather. They had a small cattle operation, so they raised beef cattle for the most part. And so he was the last person to actually have the farm in production. My great-grandmother and grandmother lived there when I was growing up. As I left high school and moved away and out of Michigan, my parents moved to the farm and kind of took up setting up a homestead there. My father had like a small petting zoo and always enjoyed, you know, raising livestock for himself and raised some horses for his own enjoyment and stuff like that.
Kind of a hobby farm.
Yeah, a hobby farm. And then so we moved home in 2014. And that was when we settled in on deciding to transition it back into actual farming and to specifically vegetable production.
And why did you make that change? So you'd been out of Michigan, and here you come back to Michigan to reactivate the farm. Why?
We had our son 4 years ago, and we were living down in New Orleans, in Louisiana, actually. Molly was teaching down there, and I was playing music down there. We really enjoyed it, but we decided as soon as he was born that we wanted to move somewhere that was maybe a little bit more family-oriented. And through all that process, we're big into food and have always been big into food. And I had crossed paths with a couple other small organic vegetable farmers and producers and really saw that they were doing well and that the push for local food was really happening. So even though we didn't have any food production background, we had been familiar. We had both worked in co-ops throughout the years and health food stores and really decided we wanted to make a push at moving back to Northeast Michigan and growing vegetables.
Are you able to do farming full time?
I'm full time and have been on the farm full time since we started. Molly's worked full time on the farm as well, but also worked off farm as well. So we had some off farm income and continue to now. Our plan was to, by this year, and actually last year, halfway through the season, we transitioned to both of us just being full-time on the farm. But then another work opportunity opened up for Molly with Taste the Local Difference.
Yes, Molly, something called Taste the Local Difference certainly seems like it's a perfect fit for what you're doing on Presque Isle Farm. What is it about?
So the organization's, you know, mission was ultimately to preserve Michigan farmland. And they realized that the primary way to achieve that goal was to keep money in the local economy and help local farmers and producers. And so essentially they're working towards this idea of getting more food access, local food access to people within their community. It's sort of this fundamental thought that, you know, if you spend locally, the money actually stays local. you know, with a lot of research, they found that if every household were to spend $10 a week on local food, it would put around $1.5 to $1.6 billion back into the state economy. When I had the opportunity to become involved with them, it was very exciting. It was the fact that, you know, for me, when we had first moved here, the only way we could have gotten here was through the knowledge and wisdom of other local farmers and their willingness to share that and help us along the way. And so here was an opportunity for me to actually benefit our regional community and help to build infrastructure here There's, just such a powerful network of farmers in the northeastern part of the state, but there's just not necessarily the fundamentals that they need, the infrastructure in place to help them get their products to where they could go and offer up more markets to them. So it's just an amazing opportunity to not only benefit our own business, but really benefit the mission that we've had from the get-go, which is to keep it local and be able to support our families with what we're doing.
Deanna, it strikes me that as you and Molly talk about the mission you feel that drives your work at Presque Isle Farm, I feel like I could be talking to a farmer in Michigan in like 1860, in a sense of here we are growing and, selling to the people in our area that locally sourced food. Am I right about that? Are we kind of like moving away from big ag and back to the way things were?
It very much feels like the scale of our production is like that. And the tools we're using and the movement of small farms that's happening all over the country right now is really based in that old style of farming. But on the other side of it, we're farming and our approach is almost completely opposite of like a traditional generational farm, in that I have internet resources to consult. There's data available on what's working and what's not. There's forums across the social media on what people are doing. There's all sorts of new young farmers that are producing blogs, producing video information. There's podcasts. We're not dependent on the succession of a kind of mentorship or apprenticeship that was always necessary in the past to learn these skills. And then this networking of farmers, maybe that is old, real old school, the idea that farmers would really work together. But it doesn't seem like it's something that crosses into other industries as much, where we're willing to all share with each other what's working for us because we're trying to build a food system. And we see that there's almost like this endless ceiling to the market. So right now, the amount of food being produced by small local farms is just so tiny compared to what's being bought in big chain box grocery stores. So I think we see the potential there. We also need to network and build together so we can start taking a bigger chunk from that food system, because we want people to, on a daily basis, everything they're buying, interact with the seasons more and directly relate to the food grown in their area and their region.
Is this a good time for a young person to go into farming in Michigan, do you think?
So I think that it is a great time to go into agriculture right now, whether it's raising livestock or vegetable production. As far as building a business, it has endless potential. It is a lot of hard work, and it's not just a retreat to rural America, and it's not homesteading. There's lots of potential. Like I said, I think there's almost an endless ceiling to the market right now if the producers are there.
I would also add that we're sort of at a time presently where there are tens of thousands of acres that are getting ready to transition hands, because we're at a point where a lot of farmers are, they're aging out of the profession and they can't do the labor that's involved. But there's a huge transition going on right now. Not as big, I would think, as there should be, because there are a lot of people that are fearful to get into farming. I mean, we had no idea what we were deciding to do when we made the decision to move back. I mean, we wouldn't change it for anything in the world, but it's definitely has taken on a life of its own and become much more than we ever could have imagined it would have. But yeah, I just agree with Dion that potential at this point is fairly limitless.
I think the upfront costs of getting in, as with any business, you still need to spend money. But relatively speaking, the upfront costs, I think, can sometimes be less, even though there are land costs and whatnot, and we were fortunate enough to have access to land early on. There's lots of land grants out there. There's all sorts of resources. And I think, relatively speaking, it's fairly easy to get into financially if you're willing to take the risk and put in the work.
Some great insights from Molly and Dion Stepanski, who own Presque Isle Farm, a small centennial certified organic farm in northern Michigan. And we should look for you at the Alpena Farmers Market and the Rogers City Farmers Market.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks so much for being with us on Stateside. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on the next idea, helping potential entrepreneurs try out the food business without wagering their life savings on it. And then, how to avoid falling for a fake poll.
Professional pollsters want to get known. And if there are no names associated with the pollster, chances are something's probably up.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
If you love preparing food, it doesn't take too much to begin dreaming of launching your own business, maybe making and selling your grandma's famous pickles or your special pies. But all too often, dreams like that crash into the cold wall of reality, and the result? Broken hopes and dreams and lost capital. Enter the Incubator Kitchen at the Grand Rapids Downtown Market. It's helping fledgling food entrepreneurs grow their business without risking their life savings. Mimi Fritz is with us now. She's the president of the Grand Rapids Downtown Market. Great to have you on the next idea, Mimi.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
What is an incubator kitchen?
Well, it's multiple things. First and foremost, what we use our kitchen for is a place for folks that perhaps maybe have a recipe or an idea related to a food product. And it's required by law, and with the exception of the cottage food industry, for folks to produce their products for sale in a commercial kitchen. And this is a commercial kitchen where individual businesses or individuals can get licensed to produce their food products and then sell to the public. And oftentimes we have, as you said, a dream or a hope or an idea, and folks come in, and it takes a long time for them to actually start with that idea and then actually move into food production. So this venue gives them the opportunity to do that.
So you can dip a toe or more in the water without falling in fully.
You can. We help with recipe development, label creation, working with the USDA and the various county boards in order to help food producers produce viable products in order to sell.
And doing it, again, as you say, within the parameters of licensing requirements. So if I'm the one that wants to sell my special pie, I don't have to try to raise the money to buy all that equipment. I can come to your incubator kitchen and also get this extra help.
That's correct. We have a 5,000-square-foot kitchen. We can have up to 5 businesses in there at a time doing different kinds of production. And we also use our kitchen as a classroom for a culinary school that's located within our building. So we have multiple uses for it. We're actually not only producing startup food businesses, but we're working on producing young chefs as well.
Give us an idea of some of the tenants you have at the Incubator Kitchen.
Sure. We have a variety, anything from sauerkraut to kombucha to cold-pressed coffee, vegan meat, various bakeries, caterers in the community, and also food trucks. We have at any given time about 20 to 25 different tenants using our kitchen, and it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we know a lot of folks that have these startup businesses have other jobs, so it's really critical that we have our facility available to them when they're available.
And what do you hear from these folks? What does the incubator kitchen mean for them to try to realize that dream of being a food producer?
They're very grateful. It truly gives them the opportunity to go after a dream. And oftentimes we see that dream come to a reality, and that's really the fun part. It doesn't always happen, but when it does happen, it's truly exciting, and we celebrate that right alongside of our tenants.
Now, do they pay you for this space, or how does the funding work?
Our nonprofit 501c3 Education Foundation oversees the programs as well as the incubator kitchen component of the downtown market. And the funding comes through various fund development opportunities that we go after. And also it's funded through an hourly rate that the tenants pay. We know that oftentimes folks don't have the capital or they'd have their own facility. So our rates are very low. They range anywhere from $9 to $25 an hour, depending on the space that they're located within. They can also lease the whole kitchen if they prefer, but most folks just will rent one or two areas.
What can a community incubator kitchen like what you have at the Grand Rapids Downtown Market mean for the economy and the business climate of a city?
actually, that's why the incubator kitchen was created, is really it's an economic development project, which is what the Grand Rapids Downtown Market is in its entirety. The kitchen was developed for just the sheer fact of starting food businesses and hoping that they will, and hoping and helping them to launch and grow into larger businesses. The model was designed where they could start up in our kitchen, move into one of our markets, eventually become a permanent vendor in our market hall, and then potentially grow beyond that. What we're seeing is many folks are actually skipping a lot of those steps, and they're moving right into their own production facilities. Once they get picked up by a regional or national distributor, the capacity that our kitchen has, even though it's the largest one in the state of Michigan, is still not large enough for if you got picked up by a Spartan Nash or a Meijer or even a Whole Foods.
So they've, but meantime, they've gotten the guidance and the hand-holding. There's been a kind of a safe lane to be in to be able to be at that point where you can get picked up by a Spartan or a Meijer.
Absolutely. We have an incubator kitchen manager on staff that walks them through the very initial startup steps. We accept folks into the kitchen that are very serious about their products, and business plans are critical. We review those with them. We also work with various startup organizations in the area, whether it's the Latino Business Development Center or the Small Business Development Center, GROW, which is another organization that starts women-owned businesses, and Start Garden. So we offer all kinds of opportunities for folks to learn from some of these other organizations that exist to start up businesses in themselves, from marketing, financial, accounting, you name it. The resources are there. We also have a partnership with Varnum Law Firm, which offers our tenants the opportunity to have $5,000 worth of free legal advice as they're starting their businesses up. So our goal is to set them up for success, and we do that from every which way that you can imagine.
And this is something that could be replicated. I know yours isn't the only incubator kitchen in the state, but this could be done with tweaks to whatever the area needs very easily.
Absolutely. There are any number of incubator kitchens in the state, and oftentimes folks will use church kitchens because those are commercial kitchens, but they're also only available on the schedule of the other institutions. So it's not an inexpensive, it's a very large investment to start an incubator kitchen, but at the end of the day, what it does is it allows all these startup businesses to have the opportunity to grow and succeed in communities.
You could learn a lot more about the incubator kitchen at the Grand Rapids Downtown Market by going to downtownmarketgr.com. Mimi Fritz is the president of the Downtown Market. Thank you so much, Mimi, for being a part of The Next Idea.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This week, I spoke with Mishon Maddock of the Michigan Trump Republicans, and we got to the recent poll showing Donald Trump's low approval ratings in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
I hate to tell you, I'm talking to the media, it's fake news. Those were the same polls that said that there was no way Trump would win Michigan.
And that drew an email from our listener, Tom, in the Lansing area, who said he finds himself less likely to trust polling since the elections. He would actually like to have that trust restored. 538 is a website founded to help us all cut through the clutter of data raining down on us constantly, including political polls. Its senior political writer, Harry Enten, is here with us now. Good to have you on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Probably safe to say a lot of people are like our listener, Tom, who kind of feel that the trust they might have had in polls has been shattered.
I deal with our audience every day, and certainly there is a lower trust in polls than there once was. And part of the reason, of course, is that Donald Trump won, for instance, the state of Michigan. He also won some other Midwestern states, despite trailing in the polls. And, you know, I don't conduct polls myself, but, you know, I prophesize. You know, we have to be able to trust the polling data, and hopefully over time we'll be able to bring those people back in who want to be able to trust the polling data again.
Let's turn to your article on 538.com, which proves, unlike days of yore, it is a lot easier to put a fake poll out there and watch it spread like wildfire on social media. So you wrote about a poll released last month by an outfit called Delphi Analytica, showing Kid Rock leading Senator Debbie Stabenow 30% to 28%. We should note, even though Kid Rock has not officially declared himself a candidate for the U.S. Senate, and you did lots of digging into who or what Delphi Analytica is. What'd you find?
Well, I am someone who follows polls a lot, probably the same that most people or most males in this country follow sports. And I had just simply never heard of this polling firm before. When I heard that they had put out this poll, this kind of sexy release, I had someone who I had known for a little bit contact me and say, you know, I think that this is a fake poll. I know the people who did this poll, and they are not real pollsters. And then I started digging around, and what it turns out is I couldn't find out a single real person who was in charge of this organization. There were a lot of fake people who were claiming fake names. And it seemed to me that the reason that they had put out the poll is because they were members of the betting market. You can bet on individual political candidates to win or lose. And they had put out this poll with Kid Rock ahead, with the idea being that then they could bet and say that Kid Rock would lose because other people would be more likely to say that Kid Rock would win and they could make money off of it.
Wow. So they could short their position, in other words.
Exactly.
Wow. And then as you point out, though, despite the fact you never found a real person with a real office and a real presence, this thing could ultimately maybe make Kid Rock think of, you know what, I will run.
You know, one of the funniest things as I watched this unfold, and I understood right off of the bat that this poll was probably not on the level, was seeing different elected officials kind of run with this poll and say, oh, my God, Kid Rock has a real chance. For instance, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, retweeted the result out saying, Kid Rock is exactly what we need for this country. And Kid Rock himself tweeted out a link to this poll or an article that mentioned this poll. Then afterwards, Rock, although he has not said that he is in fact going to run, you know, he started this nonprofit voter registration drive, and it did seem that this poll perhaps pushed them a little closer to run, and that would be something. Wouldn't fake news getting a political candidate who might not otherwise run jump into the race for United States Senate from the state of Michigan?
Wow. And I'm sure if you were to try to even figure out how much fake polling is out there and was out there during the election, you probably never could really do that, but they would powerfully influence not just candidates, but voters and donors.
Absolutely. I spoke with a Republican pollster, Adam Geller, who helped poll for the Trump campaign, and he told me that public polling is very important because it helps make the news. And there are a lot of donors who will be hesitant to donate to candidates they know are going to lose. So don't be surprised in the future if there's some fake polls put out there, perhaps semi-related to a campaign or a third party that wants a candidate to win and boost that candidate's percentage of the vote up so that they get more donations, especially around the fundraising deadlines.
Harry, you said the raw data in the Kid Rock poll is strange. Give us an idea what that meant. How is it strange?
So the people who put out this poll, you know, released this raw data, and to me it was at least somewhat consistent with Google surveys, which, you know, Google allows people to conduct their own polls. If you ever go on a news website, you know, there'll sometimes be these questions that you have to click on and answer in order to get access to the article.
Yeah.
And if you look at the raw data, it was somewhat consistent with it. You know, the age brackets looked very similar. But in other ways, there were some strange things that were going on. For instance, when people answered, I prefer not to answer, in some cases, the I in the I prefer not to answer, that first I was uppercase, and sometimes it was lowercase, which is something that's just very, very odd, because if you're exporting the data from a Google survey, it should be consistent throughout the answers, and they weren't. And that was just something that was really, really strange to me. It suggested either A, they were combining multiple polls, which they didn't say in their write-up Delphi Analytica, or two, perhaps they were copying or faking some of the data, and some of it was real and some of it was fake. But that's just one example. There are other ones as well, but that was one that really stood out to me.
So how can we, the general public, who are not skilled in statistical analysis like you guys at 538 are, how are we supposed to tell the difference between a legit poll and this very fuzzy Kid Rock poll?
Well, funny enough, the day after that I put out this fake Kid Rock poll article, I also released an article that basically gives you kind of 10 steps that you can kind of look at. And one of them is exactly what we were just mentioning, right? Use common sense. You know, if the poll release that's put out has grammatical errors in it, if the candidates in the poll, their names are spelled incorrectly or inconsistently, remember, professional organizations spend a lot of money to conduct these polls. And so they don't want any errors that are in their releases, or at least not a lot of errors. So if you're starting to see some inconsistencies, that to me is a big sign that a poll might not be on the level. And I would just mention one other thing. Again, there's a whole list of 10 on the website, but essentially,
Look at the website. Look at the About Us page. Are there actual people that are behind this poll? Have I actually ever heard of this poll before? You know, we all know Pew and Gallup. Delphi Analytica, no one had ever heard of it. Even if, you know, you're an amateur and you're just following along with the news, you probably had never heard of Delphi Analytica before. And if you go to the About Us page, there wasn't any names listed in it. Professional pollsters want to get known. And if there are no names associated with the pollster, chances are something's probably up.
When we think about looking at political polls, how should voters regard them, use them or not? And then the next question, I'll let you fold them in if you want, what about journalists and news organizations?
Yeah, you know, if I'm a voter, I would not rely on polls to tell me who I'm going to vote for in most circumstances, right? And I think most voters, you know, are pretty partisan. They're not going to vote for the Democrat just because the Democrat's ahead if they're a Republican and vice versa. If they are, in fact, a Democrat, they're not going to vote for the Republican just because the Republican's ahead. But I do think that, you know, in some situations, for instance, in primaries where there are a lot of candidates who are running and their ideologies are often very similar to one another, the polls might give you a better idea of, okay, I'm going to vote for X candidate instead of Y because X candidate more closely agrees with me and has a better shot of winning. That would be perhaps the one instance in which I would use polling data if I was, in fact, a voter. But in most cases, I would ignore the polls and wouldn't look at them if I was a voter.
Yeah, because that kind of poisons the well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it does poison the well, right? You know, this is something that we've actually seen occur in primaries before. You know, go back to the 2012 Republican Iowa caucus. We did, in fact, see that Rick Santorum saw a big climb at the end of that campaign leading up to the Iowa caucus. In part, if you look at the day-to-day data from the Des Moines Register poll, which is the best poll in that state, he climbed significantly the day after there was another survey that was released that showed Rick Santorum rising. Hmm. So, in fact, polling can influence public behavior, and I'm not sure there's necessarily anything we can do about that, but it's something certainly we should keep an eye out on.
And what about journalists and news organizations?
Look, I think that polls can be great for journalists and news organizations, but we got to be smart with them, right? I think that they're great in the sense that we can understand at this point that Donald Trump is not very popular despite what he says. We see it across a number of polls. His approval rating is oftentimes in the 30s. It's at the lowest for any president at this point through their first term. That's a good way to use a poll. But a bad way, I think, to use a poll is, you know, necessarily to understand how each individual voter is feeling. We still need to do on-the-ground interviews. And what we should really be doing is meshing the polls to get us that sort of overview, that aggregate view, and then interviewing individual pollsters to get that color that I think is so important.
And be very careful of things like this Kid Rock poll, because it would be sexy to retweet that and go, well, look at this. So you're kind of saying to everybody, great big chunk of salt.
Exactly. I think it's so important to make sure that the polls that we are using in our articles are valid and good polls. If you really don't want to, you know, do too much research, it's better to not mention a poll at all than to mention a phony one. Or more than that, stick to the polls that you know. You know that Gallup and Pew Research, for instance, are going to be putting out valid polls. Stick to those instead of some polling firm that you might be less familiar with.
Harry Anton is with 538. You'll find his piece, Fake Polls Are a Real Problem, plus the follow-up piece, 10 Ways to Figure Out Whether It's a Real Poll. You can go to 538.com. And Harry, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Tyler Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.